So we're going to start our afternoon session. Interestingly, our morning session started with a SCLA alumni. Our afternoon session is starting with a SCLA alumni. Stephen Rita Proctor graduated from our SCLA program, is now currently undergoing a PhD at the Department of English at York University, and dare I say, also SHRC funded. So we're doing something here right at SCLA. Insert publicity here. He's a PhD candidate whose dissertation explores the relationship between national traumas and the production of avant-garde or experimental literary movements. He is currently involved with several memorial and archival projects that aim to catalog testimonial responses to both 9/11 and the Arab Spring, and will soon be publicly launching the York University Oral History Project. So let us welcome back Stephen. Platform is yours.
Thank you. So this is a very rough, sort of unpolished paper that I have. It's just sort of pieced together notes from a few things that I've been working on. But it's interesting that in a few of the previous papers, we've touched on the question of who do we define as the witness? How do we define the witness in terms of physical proximity to the events being that were witnessed? And also the sort of difference between legal testimony versus the writing of fiction. And do we count fiction or avant-garde, different artistic responses as testimony? So these are really the questions that I focus on in my research, in particular Arab Spring. And so this paper is kind of opening up a few of the questions revolved around the diaspora, say the Egyptian or the Libyan diaspora, who are maybe living in France or England, who watch the events unfold in their home countries from a sort of exiled, exilic perspective. And so questions such as, does that experience qualify as witnessing? Do their sort of literary responses to watching the events unfold overseas in their homeland qualify as testimonial literature? These are the questions that I sort of wrestle with. So I'm going to begin with a bit of a long quote by Wendell Stevenson in an article written for The New Yorker shortly after the fall of Hosni Mubarak. And the quote is regarding the capacity for writers to affect political change. So Stevenson writes, quote, "A few weeks after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak, the novelist Alaa Al-Aswani found himself arguing with Egypt's prime minister on live TV. The prime minister, Ahmed Shafik, had been in office only a month, having been appointed in a cabinet reshuffle that was among Mubarak's last desperate efforts to appease the crowds in Tahrir Square. It was the first time that an Egyptian leader had answered unscripted questions broadcast live on TV since Anwar Sadat did so in 1977. Shafiq's answers were evasive and condescending. Aswani listened with mourning, with mounting anger, as Shafiq dissembled and batted away the questions of other guests. When his turn came, he was determined to hold the prime minister to account. Under persistent grilling by the novelist, Shafiq lost his temper, and it was the first time that many Egyptians had witnessed a ruler being dressed down so severely by a civilian. Aswani's attack on Shafiq stunned the Egyptians, but the most dramatic development was yet to come. The next morning, the show's host was woken up by a phone call from the TV station. Holy shit, a colleague exclaimed. He's out. The prime minister had resigned. End quote. So, that Aswani is credited with forcing Shafiq's resignation is really only half of the author's incredible story surrounding the events of 2011. Earlier, his 2002 novel, The Yacoubian Building, was also credited as one of the primary sources of inspiration, which led to the Tahrir Square revolts. The novel, which details the horrific conditions of living under an oppressive and tyrannical regime, was one of the first contemporary Egyptian works to break the artistic and literary silence that, at least in part, enabled the dictatorial system to persist. And it has been noted by hundreds of protesters as their direct inspiration for their revolutionary struggles. However, with the exception of Aswani's novel, the pervading silence within the literary and artistic community, in fact, it's probably best described as enforced censorship, makes it somewhat difficult to place the Yacoubian Building within a defined literary context or genre of what we might call pre-Arab Spring protest literature. Of course, since 2011, there's been a literary boom within North Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. But assessing the social and political implications of Aswani's novel and others like it that were written during the rule of the dictatorial regimes is difficult simply because we don't have very many of these types of protest works to measure against one another. The other two major texts being Albert Kosseri's The Colors of Infamy, which was published in 1999, and Khaled Al-Kanissi's Taxi in 2006. And so adding to the difficulty is the fact that the scant number of authors and artists who dared to lay bare the unspeakable conditions in their native countries under such regimes were often forced to do so from either forced or voluntary exile in neighboring countries. So their credibility as so-called true witnesses was often called into question by underhanded officials looking to discredit them. Within a strictly Arab literary context, and this is also something that I think is worth commenting on, is that what it means to bear witness or to produce testimony is often a social construct. So reading testimonial literature within the Japanese cultural context about Hiroshima, for instance, is very different than providing testimony in a sort of North African context. So what we have, what we deem to be testimonial responses to trauma is often varies quite drastically between cultural situations. So within a strictly Arab literary context, these works would typically only fall under the rubric of exilic literature. And this would certainly be very helpful to sort of analyze them as such. However, the phenomenon of exile in the Arab world is particularly complicated and one that calls for a very nuanced approach as opposed to, Western Europe, with careful regard for sectarian conditions, political persecution, and shifting socio-economic circumstances. What Arab exilic literature does not typically account for is the status of the exile as witness. Witness or testimonial literature from that region is often limited only to autobiographical works or what are known respectively as either prison literature or the ineffectually titled woman's literature. Inevitably, what we're left with amounts to a rather strict divide then within Arab context between non-fiction accounts of traumatic experiences, often written in epistolary form, memoirs, diaries, that sort of thing, and novels, such as those by Aswani or Kanissi. The problem, however, is that the protest novel, which is often written in exile, is all too often regarded as mere fabrication and as being entirely divorced from the reality of life under such dictatorial regimes as the Mubarak government, for instance. And it's further stripped of any testimonial authority due to the physical distance constituted by the emigre's geographic locale. On the other hand, the testimony of the memoirist is often subjected to an overly rigorous or unreasonable standard of interrogation. Such inquiries into the so-called truthfulness, and as we sort of touched on this earlier, such inquiries into the so-called truthfulness of testimonial accounts, particularly those by women, are predicated on, very strange, uh, Yes, the testimony of the memoirist is often subjected to an overly rigorous and unreasonable standard of interrogation. Such inquiries into the so-called truthfulness of testimonial accounts, particularly those by women, are predicated on demands for precision and the capacity to verify one's accounts. But as we know, and as Nora touched on earlier, traumatic memories are commonly messy. They're disorganized, riddled with gaps and omissions, and are subject to the flux and inconsistencies associated with psychological states of duress. So any attempt to infuse one's testimonial account with those literary techniques that might suggest such inconsistencies or incongruencies are, however, regarded as weakening the veracity of the testimony, and are therefore almost always avoided. This is, again, strictly within the Arab literary context. What we're left with, then, are simply testimonial accounts that resemble the juridical or legal statements of defendants, and which correspond to the legal necessity of providing objective, verifiable facts, as opposed to subjective, personalized representations of the truly horrific sensibilities of living under such oppressive conditions. So, in other words, the victim is often placed into the position of the defendant in the sense that they're forced to narrate their traumatic experience within the strict pseudo-juridical testimonial form. One possible way around this dilemma, though, I think, might be to look to the distinctive literary phenomenon known as the dictator novel, which swept through several Latin American nations in the 70s and 80s, at a time when many of these nations were suffering under brutal dictatorial regimes of their own. These novels not only served as modes of resistance to the oppressive regimes by underscoring the relationship between power and speech, but they also provided a means of testifying or bearing witness in ways that captured the illusory sensibilities of traumatic experience. Julio Cortazar's A Manual for Emmanuel, Alejo Carpanche's Reasons of State, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's The Autumn of the Patriarch, and Augusto Roa Bastos's I, the Supreme, were soon followed over the next few decades by Tomás Eloy Martínez's The Perón Novel, Roberto Bolaño's Distant Star, and Mario Vargas Llosa's The Feast of the Goat. Some of these aren't conventionally considered to be dictator, fall within the genre of a dictator novel. But for the most part, they all conform to that the rubric by which we gauge the dictator novel. Besides the familiar subject matter and the respective social-political implications of each of these novels, what's unique among them is that the authors also wrote from the unique position of what we might call a transnational witness, as opposed to simply calling them exilic writers. That is, the witness who attests to the horrific conditions of one nation, often their own nation, from the perspective of another. Marquez's novel, which is based on an amalgam of several Latin American dictators, was written from Barcelona with a watchful eye on the escalating situation in Chile. After it was published in 1975, Marquez vowed to, quote, not write again until the fascist dictator Pinochet of Chile was disposed, end quote. Likewise, Carpanche's Reasons of State about the Machado regime in Cuba was written from the author's exile in Paris, where he fled after a brief stint in prison. On the other hand, while Bastos's I, the Supreme appears to be a depiction of the infamous 19th century Paraguayan dictator, Dr. Franquia, it more subtly represents the horrors of the Alfredo Stroessner regime. Like the others, Bastos's novel was composed during a period of political exile spent both in Argentina and France, from where he observed the horrors of his native country. Losa's The Feast of the Goat, on the other hand, was written about the Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo, as the author bore witness from both Peru and Spain. Similarly, Martinez's novel was written from exile in Venezuela, Cortazar's was written from exile in Paris, and Bolaño's By Night in Chile and A Distant Star, I think they both can be considered in the same context. Both reflect the author's experiences of witnessing the Pinochet regime from living abroad in Mexico. While each of these works are often categorized as an exilic literature, the designation dictator novel also reflects a certain degree of subjective, first-hand experiences of living under the brutal dictatorial regimes about which they wrote. or at least very, at the very least, under similar oppressive conditions. So perhaps it's a testament to the authors themselves, excuse me, or to the people of Chile, Peru, Argentina, Venezuela, and Cuba, that the author's status as witness is never explicitly called into question, with the exception, of course, of Bolaño. Despite the exilic perspective of the authors and the surplus of their experimental literary techniques which pervade each of these texts. Instead, on the whole, the subgenre seems to approach the witnessing of trauma by embracing what Giorgio Agamben calls, quote, the aporia of historical knowledge, that is, the non-coincidence between facts and truths, between verification and comprehension, end quote. It is, in other words, through a conceit that it is only those who have perished who could ever truly comprehend the horror in its absolute entirety, that the novelist is able to then grapple with this aporia in search of the unconventional means of speaking the unspeakable. In a similar vein, Kathy Caruth's insistence that, quote, the most direct seeing of a violent event may occur as an absolute inability to know it, end quote, perhaps bestows the author of the dictator novel with the capacity to approach the traumatic experience beyond the purview of the juridical testimonial form, which is limited, of course, by that which limited to only that which can be verified to have been seen or to be witnessed, to have been witnessed. What's particularly unique about this form is that it seems to challenge the traditional Western definition of the act of witnessing, which demands, as Jacques Derrida suggests, that the immediacy of witnessing be one of several unequivocal testimonial conditions. And indeed, he's referring here to an extreme type of immediacy, being in direct proximity, physical proximity to the traumatic event. On the contrary, the form of Bolaño's Night by Night in Chile, for instance, is that of a witness telling a story about events which he likely did not witness firsthand. And this form allows the text to function simultaneously, I think, as an ethical act of remembering, while also as an explicit act of creation. Similarly, Roa Bastos's I, the Supreme, is presented mainly as a sort of heteroclite collage of historical documents and so-called facts pertaining to the chronological history of Paraguay. As Marjorie Agosin and Barbara E. Pierce know, quote, this is another long quote, the presentation of concrete facts, such as the writing of Dr. Francia himself, makes this novel distinct from the concept of pure fiction. Here, Roa Bastos assumes that history, as created through his creative writing, does not belong solely to him as author, but also to the official chronological history of Paraguay. In great part, the book is formed by the personal memoirs of Dr. Francia, while also including memoirs of those opposed to him. The most interesting part of this text, then, is the inclusion of the footnotes. The voice of the writer describing the formation of the book appears in the footnotes. The elaboration of the notes and the composition of the collage converts Roa Bastos into a type of judge who, in squircos, verifies what has happened by means of ordering his writing. End quote. Excuse the long quote there. In this way, I think Roa Bastos kind of parodies the juridical or legal testimonial form in which the victim is expected to sort of prove the so-called facts and objective historical details of the traumatic experience that testimonial literature in the Arab world has come to demand. Instead, the transnational witness, as opposed to just thinking of these authors as the exilic writer, the transnational witness's act of producing a work that, at least on some level, serves as a testimonial account is a gesture in which the historical accuracy or testimonial verifiability, maybe you can say, gives way to the necessity of a transnational communal memory and personal testimony as a mechanism of collective healing across a particular diaspora. Whether that's the Chilean diaspora dispersed en masse after the Pinochet coup, or the Libyan diaspora in the post-Gaddafi landscape. So in the end, I think it's the very form of the dictator novel which challenges our traditional conceptions of what it means to witness a traumatic event, which opens up the act of bearing witness or giving, producing testimony into the creation of a shared transnational communal memory.